Folks, it's a real pleasure for me to effectively be at an event like this in my own backyard. I'm Alec Wood. I know one or two faces in the room already. I'm Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire, or at least I am for the next 2 months, when at some point during September I will be retiring from policing and will no doubt be replaced by somebody else who's ready to take the force on to the next stage. In fact, today and tomorrow is the selection process for my successor. If I look a bit paranoid, that's probably why. I just was reflecting as I drove over from Huntingdon, where our headquarters is, about kind of the experience I've had in policing in 32 and a bit years now. And I think it's fair to say an organisation that all the time I've been in a serving officer has prided itself in its presentation of evidence to courts in terms of the criminal justice system has been pretty slow and lethargic in terms of the way it deals with evidence in relation to the way it does its own business. And it's really quite an interesting perspective to think, well, you know, back in the 1980s when it was around how we professionally presented evidence in front of a jury, to a court, it was always to a very high standard. And yet it was a bit finger in the air around where do we put our people, why do we do what we do, and why do we not do other things. And I really am of the view that as I leave the service, it's a very exciting time for policing generally to actually recognise effectively what evidence-based methods can do in terms of making sure we do the right things at the right times for the right people. And that's one of the most exciting challenges I think the service is facing up to, and recognising that we've got the opportunity to do some stuff with as we move forward in policing over the next 10, 20 years. So this session, on my right, I've got my colleague James, who is a superintendent from Cambridgeshire and a cohort from 2 years ago, and Niall, who is assistant chief from who's an acting sergeant. That's what happens when you arrive really late. I apologise. Niall, you, I know you, chief. Well, I'm sure we can sort something out. Over to you. Thank you.
Do I need to click anything on this to anyone that knows?
Okay, in that case, the last time I presented on this topic, the legendary Sir Dennis likened watching the presentation to trying to take a drink of water out of a fire hose. So if there is any part of it that you want to discuss later, if my email addresses are up there on the screen. So there were two main driving forces to this project. The first was that Sussex Police fronted £10,000 in 12 weeks paid leave for me to do the finest master's degree in the world, so I had to do something to pay them back. The second was a frustration with the array of single-issue risk assessments currently in policing that are wholly incompatible with each other. So as a quick anecdote to explain this, for my first weekend night as an acting sergeant on response, I hadn't worked on response maybe 5 years, and suddenly I'm the ranking response officer on a district covering 180,000 people. Lost my place. When my team started the shift, as usual work and a high-risk missing person. Then a stranger rape comes in. 15 minutes later, there's a serious crash and the driver runs off. 20 minutes after that, a man staggers out into the street with stab wounds. He was in bed with a woman when her boyfriend came home, and now the boyfriend has locked himself in the flat with her. I'd run out of officers at the time of the serious crash, so I had to decide which of those incidents I could take officers away from. So the long story short is two people died. So there are 2 points to that story. The first is that any prioritisation scheme or risk assessment that can't be compared to competing demands is pointless, because there will always be competing demands. The second point is that people live and die and are kept safe and come to harm as a result of actions that are taken and not taken as a result of frontline risk assessments. Now, the data from this project indicates that the greatest risk is immediately after a safeguarding incident, so the accuracy of risk assessment at first point of contact is absolutely vital. Good, does work. A little bit of context, Sussex Police, down on the coast, quite a rural force. We've got a population of 1.6 million in 3,800 square kilometres of land. We've got quite a lot of sea that we cover as well, but the fish mostly behave themselves. We have the seventh lowest ratio of police officers to head of population. Or to put it another way, there are six forces in England and Wales we can look at and think, I'm glad we're not them. As a part of measure of changes to provide cost-effective policing, three separate departments, each covering child protection, domestic abuse, and public protection, were merged into safeguarding investigation units. And these units only took on the highest risk cases. This project was in part to find a simple way to identify high risk and prioritise the cases across those separate specialisms. So the way that I did it was I calculated for every safeguarding offence the amount of safeguarding harm in Cambridge Crime Harm Index days that the same suspect was accused of in the next year to see which attributes were correlated with an increased risk of high harm. There were three types of attributes that I looked at, which were the number of prior accusations of safeguarding offences, the type of offence by Home Office code, and whether they were in the power few, the small group of suspects causing a disproportionate amount of harm. And then to test the prioritisation schemes, I used each to pick roughly 1,600 suspects from the 2011 to 2015 data set that were most likely to commit high harm in 2016. And then I compared this against a sample of suspects that were retained by the Safeguarding Investigation Unit. Okay, so what you're looking at with these graphs is effectively how risk changes over time. So the prevalence of high harm follow-on incidents is greatest in the days immediately after a safeguarding offence, and it rapidly drops off before levelling out. So this data, to some extent, very much validates the short-term intensive protective measures as those first few months are really when the risk is very much concentrated. So a little bit of detail on why I chose that method for the prioritisation schemes. First one there, with the cross-instrument reliability, what I mean there is there are risk assessments that find a correlation to harm using one instrument, such as a homicide review, and then assume that the same correlation exists with another instrument, such as a police officer, asking that question as part of a 27-question form. Second problem with the homicide review approach to building risk assessments is that reviewing something terrible changes your perception of preceding events, imbuing meanings to events that weren't there at the time they happened. Third, the external validity problem is a question of whether data applies elsewhere. So crime is not a uniform phenomenon. We have Bland and Ariel showing abuse does not escalate, and evidence from Sweden that was just presented as well. We have studies from Australia showing that it does. There are parts of America where there are consistently more male victims of domestic homicide than there are female. In the southeast of England, there's a rough parity between the two. In the east of England, the victims are overwhelmingly female. So if you have a risk assessment based on a couple of years' study of intimate partner homicide in London, the risk factors that are identified might not apply to violence between siblings in Cornwall. Last point, there, point four, is about the output. So a true risk assessment should have three parts to it. So probability, impact, and proximity, or effectively, how likely is it to happen, how bad it was going to be, and when is it going to happen. By having a fixed definition for impact and proximity, which is the high harm and the within 12 months, the risk assessment provides just a single number, which makes it easier to use, but also provides a standardised metric for risk. This gives us the opportunity to build other risk assessments for other specialisms to provide compatible outputs to improve overall prioritisation. So, for example, a missing person with 3.5% risk of coming to high harm could be prioritised over a domestic abuser with a 2.8% risk of causing high harm, or an antisocial behaviour incident with a 1% risk of high harm. You can all have specialised risk assessments for each specialised area, so long as they provide compatible outputs, it improves prioritisation across the whole spectrum of policing. So here is the first lot of data about the three proposed ways of prioritising safeguarding offences. So the graph top left, that shows the prioritisation, top left shows the prevalence of high harm reaccusation within a year by the number of times the suspect has been accused of safeguarding offences. that the prevalence rises with each offence count, but the problem with the data is that domestic violence needs to reach offence count 4 to equal the risk from first-time sex offender, and it will never reach the risk from a repeat sex offender. So simply going on offence count will prioritise domestic abuse risk over sexual offender risk. The form bottom left, that tracks the high harm reaccusation for the safeguarding suspects from 2011 through the years 2012 to 2015, and it's split into the power few and the other offenders. What's fascinating about this is whilst the power few for domestic violence causes more harm in the following years, the domestic violence power few is a blue line, second from bottom, and the orange is the non-power few, so if you've got the power few, cause more harm, no real surprises there. But the power few for sexual offending is the grey line there. It causes roughly half the follow-on harm, so half the high harm reaccusation rate as the non-power few. So with that split, I'm not anticipating the power few as a prioritisation scheme will be hugely effective, but that's okay because the other two are actually a lot easier to use anyway, a lot easier to calculate. Now the right-hand side of the screen shows the high harm reaccusation rate within a year for the 20 most common safeguarding offences. What's really interesting about this is that it's so very different to decades of proven recidivism rates as per the studies of Redsinovitz and as per the publications of the Ministry of Justice. All of those indicate very low recidivism for sex offenders and high recidivism for violent offences. But if you look at, what's the way the microphone is, but if you look, can you actually read that? Is it bigger? Okay. So, people accused of GBH with intent. Second from right, that one just above there, have about the same risk within 12 months as those accused of flashing. Sexual exposure. That one, not my hand there.
There's a laser pointer in the cuff right now.
Oh, that's it.
It's tall as four. Keep pushing buttons so it makes a red light.
Okay, so we've got GBH with intent, and you've got sexual exposure. So you've got roughly the same, risk. It really turns prioritisation on its head, because those aren't risks that you would, that's not what you'd think with those incidents. Consider when was the last time that we put the same amount of effort into finding a suspect for a flashing as we did for somebody being stabbed? And equally, we've got, see if the light works again, domestic abuse burglary dwelling. Where's that one gone? So I'm hurting my own neck. Now, burglary dwelling, there. Twice the risk of domestic abuse GBH. So, is it really, these are the areas that I can see professionals getting wrong in the risk assessments because it's so against what you think, where you think the risk would be. So, after all that data, the big question is, are any of these schemes more accurate than the current scheme of using professional judgment to prioritise cases? And the answer is no. Prioritising by offence count was slightly more accurate than the current scheme, but not significantly so. Prioritising by offence type was slightly less accurate than the current scheme, and considering the results on the previous page, it's no surprise that PowerView came in last. But still 50% more accurate than selecting suspects at random. So, the next question is, where can we go from here? I did find that actually targeting the most harmful domestic abusers and the least harmful sex offenders was more accurate than any of the other schemes. But I can't see being able to convince people to prioritise low-harm sex offenders over high-harm sex offenders. I don't think there's a business model that my superiors will follow. However, one area that prioritising by offence type and offence count is superior to the current scheme is celerity. All of the information that you need for those schemes is in the initial report, so risk assessment can be done at the first point of contact. Sussex Police stopped dealing with low-level domestic abuse over the telephone after the HMRC told us off for doing so. So now we have to have a triage at first point of contact Every domestic incident will have a police officer attendance. That could be in a couple of days, depending upon the victim availability, the officer availability, everything else that's the competing demands going on. And then there'll be a couple of days, perhaps, for the multi-agency safeguarding hub to evaluate the risk assessment form. So it could take several days to get that risk assessment done. And that point there, that is the risk the very next day after a safeguarding incident. So if you're waiting 7 days to get the risk assessment done, when the highest harm is immediately the day after that first incident, that could be where this steps in. So from that you can see why accurate risk assessment at the first point of contact is a necessity. The second way to improve targeting for safeguarding is by integrating the results. The safeguarding investigation units appear to be very good at identifying which suspects in low-risk categories are a concern, but the workload is still dominated by the low-risk categories. For example, even though at 2.69%, the first-time suspects they target are well above average, they are a lot lower risk than the repeat suspects up to count five. That's the data there. But they account for 40% of SIU cases, so rebalancing the workload towards repeat offenders would dramatically increase their accuracy. And I would just like to finish with a few bits that I found fascinating. So we've got bottom left, we've got the proportion of victims that suffer high harm at the first offence. And initially, it doesn't really change with the suspect's offence count. So as there seems to be an escalation in high harm or increased prevalence of high harm incidents, the more incidents there are, does moving to a new relationship reset the suspect's risk? And the proportion of suspects that cause high harm at first offence increases with the victim's prior victimisation, so that could simply be a reporting issue. We've got the two graphs at the top show that although people in their early 20s are at greatest risk of becoming victims and suspects of safeguarding offences, it's actually children that are suspects for safeguarding offences that are most likely to be accused of high harm safeguarding incidents within 12 months. And bottom right, interesting aspect, although men are more likely to be accused of domestic violence than women, once they are suspects, there's very little gender difference in the high harm follow-on. I didn't add on the sex offender data onto there, partly as it just confirms prior research by Finkelhor and others on the proven recidivism. But although there are a lot more male sex offenders than female, the high harm reaccusation rate for females is, for female sex offenders is greater. So my final observation on professional judgment versus data is that when professional judgment is informed by research data, that's typically generalized research that says group X is at more risk of Y outcome. But risk assessments should be about the risk from this point on, not the risk that brought that case to your desk in the first place. So when there are differences in risk categories for the first incidents and for repeat incidents, that generalised research can be very misleading. So, thank you for your time. As I said, if you've played it back in slow motion and have some further questions, there are my contact details. Thank you.
Nolan, and some fascinating, and if I may say, some challenging thinking, particularly, which I'm sure we'll come to later on, around the kind of correlation of policing and the inspectorate body and being told off by the HMRC, which is perhaps something we can talk about a bit later. So next on the list is James Sutherland, and James is somebody I know very well. He is a superintendent who works for us in our demand centre in Huntingdon, and is, as I said before, a person that's worked closely with this university for a number of years. So James, over to you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. James Sutherland, and I was interested in examining police officers' professional judgment and how accurate their intuitions about crime were. And this is something that I was interested in because discretion and professional judgment is something that is very baked into policing. It's culturally very important to us. This is Sir Robert Peel, And the quote up there is from the original instructions that were written for police officers before the Metropolitan Police even existed. And Sir Robert was wise enough to recognise, even back then, that you can't write a rule book for everything that a police officer is going to come up against. At a certain point, you have to be able to rely on an individual officer's good judgment and their discretion. And this is a cultural value which has been passed down through generations of police officers, and typically now we call it professional judgment. However, Daniel Kahneman, in his research, put some real limitations on the value of intuition, particularly when it is contrasted to an analytical or algorithmic approach. So I was interested in putting these two things in opposition to each other. How accurate are police officers' intuitions about crime compared to an analytical approach? And my vehicle for looking at this was probably the best understood area of evidence-based policing, which is around crime concentration, around offenders, and also in places. So in order to be able to answer this, I took 3 years' worth of crime data within Cambridgeshire from 2014 to 2017, and I recoded it all via the Cambridge Crime Harm Index. Now, it might not sound difficult, but if you're a second-year student and you're working with the Crime Harm Index, best of luck, have a nice summer. Sorry, Peter. It really is very tricky. At the end of this process, I had a data set of every street in this county, that's about 12,000 streets where there was at least one offence, rank ordered from the most crimogenic to the least crimogenic, and I had another data set of every offender who had committed at least one offence in the last 3 years, that's 20,000 people, rank ordered from the most prolific to the least prolific, and I had it for both crime counts and crime harm. So which streets have had the most crime and which streets have suffered the most harm. And this in itself is a very interesting data set for an operational police officer. This is an interesting thing to actually have on your laptop. So by way of illustration, where we are sat right now is nestled between two streets, Sidgwick Avenue and West Road. So when you are leaving today, which is the safest street for you to go down? Well, you might be alarmed to know that West Road in the three-year period had 49 crimes, which places it the 580th most crimogenic street in Cambridgeshire. Unfortunately, Sidgwick Avenue also had 49 crimes. So from an evidential point of view, you're probably best to stay right here in the middle for the duration of the conference. Now, what you would hope to see from this data, what is predicted by evidence-based policing and everywhere where crime concentration has been examined, is this curve, the Pareto curve or a power curve or a J curve, but effectively showing that a very small number of streets or small number of offenders are responsible for a disproportionate amount of the crime. But to the best of my knowledge, no one had actually looked in very rural areas. And by way of explanation, Cambridgeshire Constabulary has two medium-sized cities, Cambridge and Peterborough, and then an awful lot of rural areas. And it's only fair to test police officers' understanding about crime concentration if there are actually concentrations of crime. Fortunately, there was. When I looked at Cambridge, this is what I found. So a very small number of streets, which is the horizontal and the vertical is the amount of crime, suffered a disproportionately high amount of crime. This is Peterborough, Huntingdonshire, Fenland, there's really not a lot out there, East Cams and South Cams. Everywhere that I looked in this county, there were concentrations of crime. How much? Well, this is all of the curves overlaid with each other. And although there is some difference between the rural areas versus the cities, and relatively speaking, the rural areas had a lot less crime, the curves were the same and the patterns were the same. So within Cambridge, the top 1% of streets suffered 25% of crime. In Peterborough, the top 1% of streets had 27% of crime. One street in Peterborough had 1.3% of all of the crime in the entire county. So the concentrations were there, they're very real. I also looked at crime harm. Just trust me on this one, this curve was represented for all of the six districts within Cambridgeshire. And the concentrations of crime harm were very similar to the concentrations of counts of crime. So the top 1% of streets within Cambridgeshire suffered 22% of all the harm. For offenders, again, that curve was present. The concentrations are slightly less pronounced in streets, which is for policing interesting because as a service, we tend to focus an awful lot on offenders, much more than we do on places. And although you do find concentrations of crime around offenders, they're less than they are in places. So 1% of offenders were responsible for 11.4% of all the crime, and the top 5% responsible for 27% of all the crime. So you still have that power few, but they are less crimogenic than the actual places. And for crime harm, again, some concentration, less so than for the streets. So, having got this data, I then needed to actually go out and start examining, well, how accurate are police officers' intuitions and understanding about where the most crime-ridden streets are in their areas, and who are the most prolific and dangerous or harmful offenders. And in order to do this, I ran a series of workshops, effectively administering a survey, but done in small groups in person. And there's a lot of advantages to doing that. You can guarantee 100% completion, which is nice. You can explain kind of any sort of misunderstandings or definitions, which you can't do with online surveys. And most importantly, being cops, you can stop them cheating or otherwise subverting the process. And what I did in these workshops, and I worked with, I think, 129 officers in total across the six areas that we have within Cambridgeshire. And I asked them in the various workshops to rank order the streets, the top 10 streets in their district for the most crime and the most harm, and I asked them to do it again for offenders. I wasn't particularly interested in the actual ordering, what they thought was number one versus number 10, but most people find it easy when you're asking to do this to actually say, well, this is the worst and this is the 10th worst. It's just a thing that people found helpful. And most of them did try and do that. I also asked them how long they'd been a police officer, because again, culturally, policing tends to put an awful lot of stock on how long you've got in. And at a certain point, it becomes how long you've got left. But experience becomes, boss, but experience, experience is culturally very valuable to us. And if there's two people in the crew car, the one with the most experience will normally dictate where you're going. So I was interested in, well, does this actually have any impact upon how accurate their intuitions are? And finally, how confident they were in their accuracy. So how did people get on? Well, not well. Probably not well at all. So on average, a police officer in this county was able to identify 2.3 out of 10 of the worst streets in their area. And to be clear, I was only asking about their district. I wasn't asking them about the whole of Cambridgeshire. At the time, our policing model, we had six pretty much autonomous policing areas. I was only asking Cambridge officers about the city of Cambridge and Peterborough, and so on. So it was a relatively fair question to be asking. And 2.6 out of the top 10 streets are most harmed streets, so which you might have expected they would do better on. No, not really. Irrespective of whether a street had an awful lot of crime or an awful lot of harmful crime, police officers were not good at identifying them. And for offenders, it was even worse, which was surprising because, again, we focus on offenders. But the average police officer in this county was able to identify less than one out of the top 10 most prolific or most harmful offenders in their area. Now, there isn't an objective standard of what good should look like, you know, and they were never going to beat the analytical approach because the analytical approach in this particular case has a perfect result. But intuitively, it feels like it should be better than that. I think that most people thought that they would do better than that, and certainly when I tested or examined their confidence, they thought they were going to do better than that. Experience played no role whatsoever in informing the accuracy. It didn't matter, and I tested the relationship between experience and all the different categories I was looking at. But if I was to summarise it for you, and I'm happy to go in more detail over lunch, but basically it doesn't matter how long you've been a cop or how long you've been a police officer in a particular area, your intuitions about where crime is and who's doing it are as inaccurate as the least experienced officers in the area. This is, I think, interesting. And what I did find, apart from the accuracy of police officers' intuitions, is that the concentrations of crime and crime harm, wherever I looked for it, were far more concentrated around places than they were offenders, by up to 2.5 times more, which again, given how much we focus on offenders rather than place-based strategies, is I think interesting. So in terms of policy implications, I think firstly, wherever it is that you police, in all probability, you will find that there are concentrations of crime, because I have found them wherever I looked for them. And secondly, your colleagues won't know where they are. And I think that these are two things which are worthy of being addressed. Thank you.
James, thank you, and for the advice about experienced officers as well. That was much appreciated. Fascinating, really. Both Noel and James have hit on different areas and in some senses contrasting areas, but on some, I guess, some really interesting factors around, A, do we as a service in policing recognise and deal with harm in an effective way? And as James has just identified, are we, in fact, the best people to utilise professional judgment? What does professional judgment mean? And clearly, whether intuition is, in fact, an attribute or not. And it would seem in Cambridgeshire it's not. My only hope is that you'll find that wherever you've gone, James, but we shall see. So, questions from the floor to either. Yes, sir.
Jamie, I'm just interested, you know, the inaccuracy of the officers. Did you go back to them and tell them how way out they were?
Yes, but only at the end. So one of the biggest difficulties is that police officers talk. So if I were to give the answers to any group, it would have very quickly gone round and people would have started researching. But what I was able to do in the final workshops I did in any given area, I said, look, if you want to stay behind and find out how you did, I'm happy to do that. And most officers did. And it was a jaw-dropping moment for them. It was the impression that this put upon them was quite shocking. And I also did this, didn't form part of my main study, but I did an ancillary workshop just with detectives. I thought, well, I've been doing frontline officers, and detectives, I'm sure, will think that they'll do better on this. So I did a workshop with detectives, and just looking at offenders, most prolific, most serious in your area, and I let them work as a team. And I told them, because by this point I was so confident in my methods, that if they got 4 out of 10, I would buy them all donuts. So now, properly incentivized, they worked on it for half an hour. They didn't get 1 out of 10. They also found this surprising. So I think as a tool for explaining to police officers why evidence-based and analytical practices are valuable, this was quite good as a consciousness-raising exercise.
Good question. Anyone else? Larry?
I just wanted to point out the difference between doing a predictive study and doing a descriptive study. And so I think it's very interesting in finding that in the predictive study, the professional judgment was very close to the analytic prediction, And Jeff's going to have more definitive results on that in Durham along the same lines. One of the challenges with talking about concentrations and why we should know about hot spots and high-risk offenders and so forth is that many of the descriptions of who has been the most harmful offender or the most harmful locations is that there is a decay in the predictive value of that. In the hot spots we've recently seen in West Midlands, that within 1 year, you've lost about 21% of the hot spots are still hot. But that's pretty slow decay compared to what Ashley Liggins has found in Northamptonshire, in which about 90% of the hottest offenders in any 1 year are out of it, either because they're in prison, or because they're dead, or because they left, or because they stopped. But we need to start unpacking the descriptions of high risk and high harm in terms of their forward trajectory and the predictive connections. So as we compare professional judgment to analytics, I think it might turn out to be different for the descriptive versus the predictive. Although the descriptive, in a way, is the easier test to pass. And yet, we got exactly the opposite result. So I think these two studies are really intriguing and suggest a lot more master's theses that somebody in this room might be interested in doing. But I just want to thank Alec for presenting it all. It's really great
stuff.
Thank you.
How long have we got, Larry? We've got another five or so minutes for...
We have time for questions, sir.
What was the correlation between the officer's interview service in that area matching the data sample for rating the streets?
Was there any correlation between how long they've been there in a particular area and how accurate they were?
No. Just simply taking accuracy aside, just what was the degree of correlation between their service and the sample set?
Okay, I don't know. I would have to go, I don't think I was looking for that, so I would have to go in with the thesis and check.
Anyone else? Lady at the back.
I was just wondering, did you go into the reasons with the police officers and the reasons that Daniel Cardinal talks about in terms of implicit bias, so to make them feel less like they are terrible at their job and they've been asked to do this impossible task? Things like, you know, the recency theory and all you see is all there is. So explaining that actually it's got nothing to do with the police officer, but just the fact that they're a human being.
Yes, I did. Certainly at the end, because I think the ones who didn't get the results, I don't think were particularly curious, and this is just one other thing they've been asked to do. The ones who did get the results and found that very demoralising and shocking, yeah, because I think it was then important to explain to them that you've not been set up and you are not bad. This is exactly what was predicted would happen. So, yes, it is.
Sorry. What's there now?
Would it be more generous to classify the streets as high, medium, and low risk? And if you'd done that, how successful would the officers have been in categorising their streets as high, medium, and low? Did they come up with streets that were just low risk instead of high risk when they should have been predicting high risk?
It was an interesting, and I did what I tried to do afterwards, because there was any number of ways I could segment streets or places, and the reason why I seized upon streets is that police officers and taxi drivers are the two industries that are very good at remembering streets, so it's kind of a fair unit. But what I did do was go in afterwards and see, right, why are these recurring streets coming up that police officers are naming that aren't in there, and how well did they do in identifying the top 20 and the top 30? And it's something I think could do more work, but looking down the list, there's no reason for optimism, is what I would say, is what I found. And in relation to streets that kept coming up that were wrong, but weren't in the top 10 or weren't in the top 20, it tended to be places that would have a problem family, where officers would keep getting called back, but they weren't actually committing a great deal of crime. So there seemed to be, there was definitely something. I mean, police officers, they weren't picking streets randomly, but they definitely weren't picking the streets that are suffering the most crime.
James, I just wonder whether there may have been I'm just thinking it's why you may have ended up with those results you had, is whether officers were focusing on the streets that caused them personally almost the most grief in their role.
Yeah.
And so that then begs the question in terms of when we deploy people to deal with stuff, are we deploying people to the wrong things if officers aren't able to describe the sorts of things you've just identified?
I think that's exactly what they were doing. And the worry is that there is some potential bias in how police officers are then deciding where to patrol and who to target. And there's some real risks in there in terms of fairness and justice, I think.
We've got time probably for one more question, sorry, sir. Two more.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to make a link back to Hong Kong. And it's a very interesting one because you did that study in the last couple of years. I was a brand new sergeant in Southampton in 1984, and I got a Hong Kong superintendent to arrive, Louis Lau, and the very first thing he did was more or less what you did. He got every sergeant into the office with them, and he asked them to fill an acetate sheet out and show where the hot spots of crime were in Portswood, and then he, as they finished, he overlaid his acetate sheet with the real figures, and exactly what you found was there. Not one single sergeant, apart from one. And I cheated because I had just done one of the first hotspot studies because I developed or worked on a system of doing pin mapping and hotspot mapping. So I had all the maps, I had the cheats and the maps, but frankly, it was exactly the same as you found. The correlation was absolutely absent. The only thing he didn't do was the offender thing, but I don't know whether there's any Hong Kong colleagues, but this was absolutely unique. I've never seen anyone else do that in command, and it was a brilliant technique because every other sergeant for the remaining 18 months that he was there knew absolutely where, because they made damn sure, because he kept asking them again.
It's probably the same question as I don't need a microphone. It's probably the same question. Did you compare the correlations in between the zones of the officers that you asked? So the officers from one zone, did they have the same answers or the same hotspots or the same street that they...
No. So although that didn't form part of my study just because of the limitations around a workout manually, I did out of interest look at it, and there didn't seem to be any great pattern. So you might think that, well, maybe this is a result of faulty briefing or faulty shared understanding. There seemed to be, if there was a pattern in there, it defeated my ability to find it. It appeared to be random, where they were. Not random, and they weren't picking streets at random, but there didn't seem to be a shared pattern or understanding between the officers.
Okay. Oh, sorry, one more. This lady there.
Just responding to what Peter was saying about the pinpointing of the hotspot crime, I remember when I joined the force in 1983 that when we go to the briefing rooms, there were the pinheads of all the various crime, notably robberies and burglaries, will be sort of pointed on the map. So all officers who go into the briefing room should know where the crimes are, and that was 30 years ago, and now we have the crime mapping on individual sort of workstation that officers ought to be able to find out sort of where things are, and that is not necessarily sort of do it the way that Lewis does, but we kind of expect them to know where things are, and maybe that is the reason why Lewis did what he did back then.
And I think from my point of view, that's interesting. I think as much as anything, it's a challenge for leadership that we have tools that can tell us exactly where crime is happening, in what streets it's happening, and somehow we're not able to, the very people who are there out keeping us safe on those on our streets, aren't aware of that information in the way that they should be. So there's a challenge, I think, for the service, as well as there's a challenge for the way perhaps we train. And it struck me, seeing Rachel at the back from the college, that there's some real opportunities from both of the presentations, some real opportunities as we move forward and professionalise training and professionalise officers as they move through the ranks in the future, to really embed some of these principles and the principles you've no doubt spoken about before this morning, about how evidence can help, in some cases help inform professional judgment, in some cases completely replace it as an effective tool for policing. And I think that's something that, as of yet, we clearly haven't got right in the training and delivery that we've been doing thus far. So some real opportunities for us and some exciting times ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, can I thank both James and Noel for their presentations.